Warning: explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, I'm Scott David Chase. This is My Truth, Tell Me Yours. On this episode, I speak with Todd Seeley. Todd Seeley is a singer-songwriter. He is both a solo performer and he also fronts the metal trio Bigfoot from New Hampshire. He's also a former member of the seminal Oi band, The Bruisers. Some of you may know The Bruisers because their lead singer, Al Barr, went on to become the second and still current lead singer of the Dropkick Murphys. Todd is someone that I've known since I was about 14 years old. We grew up in church together. So we talked a little bit about that. We talked about Todd spending some time in Africa and just kind of following dreams. And it was great to sit down with him and have a chat. So enjoy. Hey, real quick before the episode starts, by the time you hear this, I've already begun my 51 states, 51 days road trip where I'm, you know, recording a 51 podcasts and doing a painting in each state. It's been awesome, all the support that I've got so far. But if you want to be part of that still, you can still support me while I'm on the road. Trust me, it'll help me a lot. If you go to thisismytruthpodcast.com, there is a banner at the top that'll go to the GoFundMe page. You know, you can get a postcard, you can buy a painting, you could, if you just feel like giving $5 and helping out, feel free. That would be awesome. I appreciate everyone who has supported me so far, and thanks for listening. Yeah, that's. I've had a couple people that I've reached out to because I'm doing a road trip.
Yeah, I saw that. I'm going to donate because I want a postcard from. I can't decide what state.
Oh, yet. Sweet, sweet.
I actually really like your art.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
I need to. You know, every time you post stuff, I'm like, man, I should buy stuff.
Well, next Saturday I'm doing a yard sale, but I'm also doing sort of a cleaning house of art thing. And it's not because I'm trying to, it's not like, it's just, I'm moving, everything's going into storage.
Right.
So the more stuff I can sell,
the less
I have to put away. Yeah. And it's one of those things that's, with me, with making art, with almost zero exceptions, once it's done, like, I'd rather it go to a home where someone's going to enjoy it. Because I don't really like, I'm not a big fan of having stockpiles of stuff. I mean, I know plenty of artists who will hang on to stuff for years, you know, until right. it sells. Right. But like for me, the drive is to make more. It's not yeah. like, you know, which is, it's funny because I just put in my notice at my job.
I saw that.
And so I'm preparing to be very poor for the next, you know, however long. But it's one of those things that for the last couple of years, I've always been like, I've had these couple opportunities every month and I'm like, I can't, I'm working. And I finally said, you know what? I'm 41 now. I don't want to turn around and be 55, 65 and be like, man, I wish I had pursued that. I don't want it to be my hobby. 'Cause my right. job has always been what has been able to like facilitate me being able to do the stuff I love.
Right.
And which is like, I've never really taken a whole lot, even
that's what jobs are for as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean,
unless you get really lucky.
Right. I mean, and I had a couple jobs that I really liked too. One of the people I'm going to sit down with on my trip, she runs this place called, the Mile High Grill and Inn, mm-hmm. which is like it's not a bed and breakfast. It's a, I want to say 6 or 8 room hotel above a restaurant that I bartended at.
Lives out in Arizona?
Out in Arizona in Jerome where I lived. And great person to work for. And, you know, once I started working for her, that's who I worked for until I ended up moving back. And it was, you know, if she was out here, I'd still be working for her right. today. You know, right. stuff like that. But, I was dreading giving my boss, now my notice,
It's because I didn't know how he'd react. And, you know, I've been at jobs where you say, hey, I'm going to give notice. Well, cool. You just finish out this week and don't bother coming back.
Yeah. You can punch out right now. I've seen that.
Yeah, I've seen that too. And I just didn't know. But because I actually gave him 3 weeks notice. And he's like, well, you can do the two. And then I was like, that's fine. But if you could use me for the third, I could use, you know, the work.
Paycheck, right? Until,
yeah. So he's like, okay, cool. And, he, you know, we had even talked about it. And we'll see how it goes when I come back. But my plan was to work for him at the Portsmouth location part-time during the holidays. Mm-hmm. So, which it would be mutually beneficial because it gets busier during the holidays, but also I don't have to scramble to find something when I get back.
Right.
So, but yeah, I'm just putting everything in storage. It kind of worked out. Our landlord, our lease was up and the landlord put a fairly significant increase on the rent.
Yeah.
And it was just like, well, I mean, it kind of, my aunt lives with me now, but mm-hmm. she'd been thinking about doing assisted living anyways, and it's just like what it's probably going to end up being. But it actually ends up working out better for me.
It's kind of serendipitous all this is happening at the same time.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Well, you know, I gotta tell you honestly. You said you're 41. I mean, I'm older than that.
And, right.
And to do something like this now is very cool, but it's also it's certainly what's the word I'm looking for? It's kind of an exceptional, takes an exceptional amount of courage to do that at our age.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Like, I was 39 and I got offered a job in Africa.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that anyway, so, yeah.
Are you recording right now?
Yeah, oh, okay. We've been recording for like 5 minutes.
All right, then we don't have to repeat it. All right. Yeah, I mean, 39 years old, I was in a job that I certainly was paying my bills and more, and I was using it to facilitate, you know, buying guitars and going on vacation and, you know, and all this stuff. And, but I was miserable, like absolutely, absolutely miserable. I hated waking up every morning.
Yeah.
And I got this opportunity to leave everything behind, like literally just pack up and go with no real termination date, you know?
Sure.
It was supposed to be an 18-month contract, but it was kind of open-ended right from the get-go.
Yeah.
And I packed up all my stuff, you know, and I gave a 90-day notice to a job I'd been working at for 9 years. You know, I said, look, you got 3 months. Because I needed 3 months to kind of like this. It's not like you're just moving to Massachusetts, you know?
Sure.
But what was really liberating, and you know, and well, first of all, my parents thought I was nuts. My friends all thought I was nuts. And, you know, and then my less educated friends asked all kinds of questions like, well, what are you going to do for internet? Or, you know, how are you going to cook? I'm like, well, they have electricity in Africa. They have, you know, they have satellite TV in Africa. We have cars, you know, all these things. But, you know, my parents, you know, my dad actually, he actually tried fairly hard to convince me not to go.
Yeah. Where do you think that came from?
I think the reasons were multiple. I think, you know, number one, as a parent, you know, he was just being protective.
Sure.
Worried about my safety, like a lot of Americans, doesn't really have or didn't really have a really keen understanding of how things work on that continent.
Sure.
I had been there before for a little bit, so I had a better understanding. But, you know, what we read, the only thing that most of us know about Africa is, you know, AIDS and violence.
Sure.
So, yeah, and reason number one, I think he was worried about my safety. Reason number two is I'm his only son, and we have a pretty tight relationship.
Yeah.
And we, you know, as we have both gotten older, we had started doing a lot more father-son stuff.
Sure.
And I think that was probably, he realized that was going to be difficult to let go of.
Yeah.
And finally, I think that my father and I are very different in a lot of ways, and I think he just didn't understand why I would leave a career job that was very stable and that paid well to go and do something insane.
So, you know? What were you doing beforehand?
I was managing a Mercedes-Benz service department.
Yeah, yeah.
I was working in the car business, running, you know, high-end car stuff. It was awful.
Yeah.
Great money, but, oh, man, it was painful. So I left. And to me, I didn't think there was anything brave or foolish about it. It was just what I needed to do, and I wasn't worried about it at all. And my thoughts were, if I go there and it doesn't work out, I get on a plane, I come home.
Sure.
You know, no big deal. I ended up loving it there and thinking I was going to get, you know, I was going to retire there, but
yeah,
that didn't work out either.
How long were you over there?
3.5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing a bunch of pictures, because I think, is that, are you still using the Reverend Todd Seeley when you perform?
Yeah.
Now, is that a title you hold, or is that an honorary title? Like, where did that come from?
It's kind of an interesting story. So, yeah. I went to undergrad at Lewis and Clark in Oregon, and I got a degree in theology and a degree in history.
Okay.
And I actually wanted to go to divinity school.
Okay.
And I wanted to be an ordained minister, but I actually really wanted to be a professor. I wanted to teach at a university. So I applied to a few div schools, and I actually got into, I loved living out in Portland. And I had, you know, I graduated, you know, from undergrad, and I hung out in Portland for a little while and played music. And then I decided that I wanted to go to grad school. So I applied to most of the big kind of East Coast divinity schools, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, blah, 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 blah. And I got accepted to Harvard, which was my first choice. So nice. I moved back here to get my MDiv from Harvard. And I was like, yeah, if I have an MDiv from Harvard, you know, I can teach anywhere I want.
Sure.
Who's not going to want to hire me? Blah, yeah. blah, 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 blah. But I ended up not going. They ended up pulling my financial aid package. And I was already massively in debt from my undergraduate loans that I decided that I didn't want to incur that kind of debt.
Sure.
And have to pay for it until I was 80. So I never went to graduate school. So I got a job as a welder in Seabrook.
Yep.
And all the guys that I worked with, you know, half of whom didn't even graduate high school, thought it was really funny that I had a degree in theology and I was doing the same thing as they were and making the same money as they were.
Right. And they didn't have the kind of debt that you had, probably.
Right.
Yeah.
So they all just started calling me Reverend.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it was funny
sure,
to them.
Sure.
You know. So it stuck for a while, and then I ended up deciding to make it official by getting my ordination from the Universal Life Church.
Yeah, you and I share that. I have that too. Yeah.
So now I do weddings, you know, and stuff like that. But so yeah, I mean, it's I guess technically yes, I am officially a minister, but
right.
it's more of a tongue in cheek kind of thing.
Sure.
Than
sure.
anything else.
Well, it's funny. Somebody. So when did you come back from Africa?
In 2014.
Okay, I was gonna say because that was. I think around the time that, or maybe it was before then, that because I was in Arizona at the time.
I remember because I would see your post from Arizona while I was in Zambia.
Yeah,
you know,
and then I discovered that we knew a bunch of people in common that we hadn't grown up with. Because because I've actually known you for, most of the time that I've lived in New Hampshire, which is we moved here in '88, but you're a couple years ahead of me, so. I didn't know you well. I more knew your parents growing up than anything, but it was one of those things that I was like, how does this person know Todd? How does this person know Todd? And then somebody asked me, like, is he a real reverend? Or I was like, I honestly don't know the story behind that. So I was curious about that. But yeah, that's an interesting story.
Yeah. And, you know, and like you, I actually, when I went to college, I had no intention of getting any kind of religious degree.
Sure.
But at you, and that's another thing that you and I share is our childhood growing up in church.
Sure.
You know, we certainly share that same tradition.
Yeah.
But I actually was, you know, I just wanted to get a degree in history and teach, and I decided to take some elective courses in theology just because I wanted to maximize the amount of money I was spending on college.
Sure, sure.
And I really liked it, and so I decided to do a double major, so I got 2 degrees. And I ended up actually liking the kind of the theological studies more than the historical stuff, honestly. And I was really, really psyched to go to graduate school, but interestingly enough... A while ago, I stopped believing that things happen for a reason.
Sure.
I spent most of my life thinking that things happened for a reason. And then I went through a long period, several years, where I really just refuse to believe that anymore.
Yeah.
And now I think I might be headed back in that direction.
Sure.
You know, because you sit there and you think, well, what would have happened if I had gone to Harvard grad? You know, where would my life be right now? Where would I be living? What would I be doing? Or what would have happened if I had never went to Africa? You know, what would have happened if I hadn't come home from Africa? You know, and I came home from Africa under circumstances that were less than ideal and, you know, kind of sort of against my will.
Yeah.
I didn't want to leave, but I had to. You know, and you think about these things, and then, but then, you know, like I look at where I am now and you know, my life and my relationships with people, and I'm, you know, maybe this is where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Or maybe it's where you're supposed to be right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's funny because I'm kind of the same way as far as like, for the longest time, I was like, well, I guess stuff happens for a reason. And but to me, that's sort of a throw in your hands in the air.
Yeah.
Ah, fuck it. Where
right.
I really do feel you play a part, at least I play a part in my own
of course.
Happiness. And
yeah, absolutely.
And,
no question.
And that was the thing where, you know, and it wasn't, you know, because I'm a slow learner. You know, it's taken me decades to figure out, oh, if I hang out with miserable people all the time, I'm going to end up being miserable.
Yeah, it took me, you know, I consider myself to be pretty smart, but it took me a while to figure that one out, too.
Yeah. Yeah. you know, particularly in like, you know, romantic relationships, but also just pursuing what I thought people thought I should be doing. And, I mean, because I've had conversations with people in the last couple of weeks about, oh, that's a crazy thing that you're doing. That's, you know,
it's an awesome thing that you're doing.
I'm so psyched about it. Yeah, there's definitely a scary element, but
of course.
But the way I look at it is, when I left, because I moved out to Arizona working for Best Buy, and then left to open up a record store.
Yeah.
And I ended up bartending at that, you know, that restaurant to pay the other bills.
Yeah.
And but I was basically flying by the seat of my pants without a net for 3 years with pretty much no support network out there, and I was fine.
Yeah.
And I have an incredible support network here. So I'm like, if I'm pursuing my dream, something that not only gives me fulfillment like nothing else has, but it's something that I'm actually good at, I'm just like, I'm going to be fine.
Right.
I'm, you know, and I also have friends like, you know, Dan Blakesley, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dan's been doing it for like 17 years. Yeah. There's, you know, and this is not talking smack about Dan. Him and I have had this conversation, but there are months where he's got like $6 in his bank account, but he's living life on his own terms. And,
absolutely.
You know, and the amount of lives that he touches with his art, both visual and music, is, you know.
And honestly, I think that's a very courageous lifestyle. I really do. And there are so many people that they just can't do that.
Right.
They can't or they won't. You know, and even me, like, I have had, you know, when I came back from Zambia, I was like, well, once I'm back on my feet, maybe I'll just get in my truck with my guitar.
Yeah.
And I'll do the Hank Williams Sr. thing and just, like, find a place to play every night for gas money and for beer.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But not drink myself to death, but, you know, like...
sure,
but,
sure.
But just be that kind of itinerant, nomadic music guy.
Yeah.
You know, what the hell? I didn't have anything better to do, really.
Sure.
But something prevented me, something told me not to do it. I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just a little voice in my head, but... and it's still something that I think about doing, and I love playing music. I mean, it's my favorite thing to do in the world.
Yeah.
You know?
The whole time I've known you, you've played music.
Yeah.
Was piano your first instrument?
Trumpet.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, trumpet was my first instrument, and then I realized in high school that you couldn't really score chicks with the trumpet.
Unless you're Chet Baker.
Unless you're Chet Baker, but he was exceptionally cool.
And he also scored heroin a lot, too, so
Yeah, exactly. That chiseled profile and the heroin, So I switched to guitar because I thought, you know, girls would find me cooler if I played
guitar. Sure.
And I actually really like playing guitar, and I was much better at it than trumpet.
Yeah.
I play piano a little bit too, but I'm all self-taught. I'm not certainly far from
a
virtuoso.
I have this, it's funny because I have a image of you at church playing, and it wasn't like in a service, but you were sitting at the piano, and it was like the first time I had seen someone who wasn't in my family, who wasn't like an adult,
yeah,
playing the piano, and that stuck with me, really? In my mind, which may have been one of the only times, you know, that you were sitting down.
I actually really love playing piano, and if there's a piano around, I will play it. I wish I was much better at it. I used to play the piano at church, you know, never in a service or anything like that. But yeah, I remember that. In fact, I think somewhere I have a picture of me in one of like the fellowship halls, you know, at the Old Bethany.
Yeah, yeah. In Rye.
Yeah, in Rye, playing piano, and your brother's in the picture, your older brother.
T.
Yeah, T's in the picture.
Interesting. That might have been the same instance that I'm thinking
of. It could have been.
Yeah.
And I think we were rehearsing for something.
Yeah.
I was just kind of screwing around waiting. We were all waiting for,
you know, the person in charge. Yeah. It's interesting because I know that they did several musical performances at that church.
Yeah, it was, and that's what it was. It was, Godspell.
Okay.
I think it was Godspell, and I got kicked out of that.
Really?
Yeah, kicked out of a church production. That was pretty cool.
For what?
Creative differences with the director. Which now that I'm older, I know you just don't do those things.
Sure.
You
know? Sure.
It's the director's show, and they make the decisions.
Right. If you by agreeing to do it, you're agreeing to their terms. Yeah. To within reason.
Right. But at 18 years old, I knew everything.
Man. Sure.
You know.
It's funny because like I go through these periods like of self-reflection like every 3 or 4 years where I'm like, oh man, when I was 36 I was so full of shit and I thought I was so smart, but I've got this figured out now, and man, and then sure 5 years from now I'll be like, man, when I was 41 thought I had it figured out, I was an idiot. And I think, you know, I think going through life you just keep getting that. I mean, you're always learning.
Right.
I mean, it's funny. I don't know if you've seen, I do this thing every day at the end of my day on Facebook. I put the what I learned today.
No,
thing.
I haven't seen that.
And it's funny because I legitimately just started doing it for myself because I found myself when I was pretty miserable when I was in Arizona for most of the time. I mean, there were things that I liked out there, and I've certainly made some great friendships that I've kept in contact with, but I felt pretty isolated most of the time, and I would go like weeks at a time, and I'd be like, I don't think I've done anything worthwhile this week. Like this week was a wash. There was nothing great about it, and I was like, that's bullshit. There's got to be something every day that, like, because I always look at it as like, you got to learn something every day to self improve.
Absolutely, I agree with that 100%.
Even if it's just, oh, you know, you got to turn the little knob on the lamp twice to get it to turn, you know, most of us figured that out on your own, you know, when you were like 6 or 7. But so I decided to just start recording it on Facebook, and it was what I learned today. And it's funny because sometimes people will come in, they'll be like, you didn't know that? I'm like, no, clearly I just stated. Or people are like, duh, thanks for telling me something. I'm like, it's not actually for you. If you enjoy reading it, great. Right. But it's just what I, and it's more for me to take the time to kind of reflect and be like, all right, so what did today give me?
Right.
You know, and then, but I also, you know, my brain's hardwired to be negative, sarcastic, pessimistic. Mm-hmm. And so I also make myself do the highlight of the day, which is because I've had some real shit days. I mean, I'm sure you have. Of course. We all do.
Yeah,
it's part of being human.
Yeah.
But there's got to be something really good in that day. Even it's, hey, I had a cheeseburger today and it was really tasty. Or, you know what? Someone let me go ahead of them in the traffic merger. You know,
right.
So it can be anything like that. But just basically that there's no such thing as a day that's a total wash.
Right.
You know, even if it feels like it, you know. And it also kind of, for me, just puts everything in perspective of, okay, well, the day wasn't complete shit. Even if on paper, sure it was.
Right.
So, you know, I started doing that.
Yeah, I know a couple of people on the Facebooks that do what I'm thankful for today.
Sure.
And that, you know, that that's cool too. I have reduced my social media footprint.
Sure.
You know, in the last year, I just decided that I don't know if it's just getting older or different perspective on things, but I've decided just kind of keep more things to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And not air everything out there anymore.
I can,
you know,
totally understand
and,
that.
And not that I think that the other way of doing things is wrong. And I think it's cool that people are happy to share what they're thankful for. And you know, and I certainly don't have a problem with that, nor do I have a problem with people saying, this is what I learned today. This is what happened today that was good. I think that's great. But I just, I don't know. I don't know if it's, I think it's just where I am right now. For a while, pre-presidential election and post-presidential election, all I did was nothing but political posts for months. And then I stopped doing that for a little while. And then I started, every once in a while I'll have like a two-day rampage where I'll just post all kinds of political stuff. I don't know. I feel like I have better uses of my time.
Sure.
Right now, I was just having a conversation with my girlfriend this morning about the value of time and how much it means to me. And like, so this, and that was the other thing that pissed me off about this guitar store experience this morning is I drove an hour out there,
right,
with every intention of buying this amplifier,
right,
1981 50 watt high watt half stack matching cab, like not really not the holy grail of amps, but it's up there, you know, and it's rare and the price was decent, and but it was more than I could justify spending right now, like just straight out of my pocket. So I brought two pieces of gear that I really, really like, but that I would like less than this new piece of gear.
Sure.
So I drove an hour out there, and this was after having a conversation with my girlfriend this morning over breakfast about how important time is and like time versus money and all these things. So I drove out there for an hour. I played it. I brought my own guitar, my main guitar. I played my guitar through this half stack, and it was fucking awesome. I mean, it sounded amazing. It was so, I was like, yep, I have to have this. Like, I have to have it. And so I basically, you know, like I told you before, so I've got these two pieces of gear in my truck. I would like to bring them in, and I would like you to tell me what you'll give me in trade towards this, because I want to take this home with me. And one of the things that I brought was an amplifier that weighs a million pounds. Yeah. And I hate lugging it around.
Sure.
I hate bringing it up and downstairs. And I told the guy specifically, I said, I don't really want to bring this back inside my house and bring it back down to my basement.
Which you're basically telling them, if you're within reason, I'll take whatever you're offering.
Yeah. See, you're not stupid. You figured that out, right? I mean, it's like the implication is pretty clear.
Right.
I told him that I wanted it. I told him I came here specifically for this.
Yeah.
I told him I didn't want to come home with this stuff. And he basically said, yeah, I don't want to look at your stuff.
Yeah.
Even though it's like, you know, it's high-end stuff. You know, it's not like, you know, some Chinese-made shitbox amplifier. It's a Mesa Boogie, you know? And so I politely, surprisingly, this is another thing that happens as I've gotten older, is I've become more tolerant, at least on the outside.
Sure.
You know, and I'm fuming inside. Like, this morning I was, like, fuming. And I politely put my guitar back in its case. Here's the other thing. He said, well, why don't you try to sell your stuff on Craigslist? And I looked at him and said, because I don't have fucking time to do that.
Sure.
Another implication that I want to do this now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm willing to get less money for my stuff to save my time.
Yeah.
Time and money, all of these things, right? And he basically was just like, yeah, well, good luck, you know? And so I politely put my guitar back in his case, closed it up, shook his hand and said, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And walked out the door.
Yeah.
And drove an hour home. So, and meanwhile, like, my intention this morning was I was going to go on a 20-mile bicycle ride.
Yeah.
And that's what I really wanted to do this morning.
Yeah.
But I didn't do it because I really wanted to see it.
Sure.
So I went out there, and 2.5 hours later, I'm back home, and I have just wasted 2.5 hours, and I could have been doing something that I really love to do.
Right.
That is good for me as well, you know, all of these things. And instead, I'm just, like, home now, you know, like, pissed off.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
And now I'm going to post these things online and see if I can get somebody to buy these two pieces of gear. And now I'm at a moral crossroads, but like it's certainly a crossroads based on principle where if somebody buys these two pieces of gear for me, then I can go get that amp. But now do I really want to give this guy my money?
Sure.
You know, the thing is I could buy this exact same setup from somebody else, but for quite a bit more than what he's selling it for.
Sure.
So now I'm like, fuck, what do I do?
Yeah, is your money or your, I don't even know if it would be pride thing, because it's not like he embarrassed you.
Yeah, right? it's not pride, it's just principle.
Yeah, for sure, know? For sure. Yeah.
I mean, I was a douchebag.
Yeah, and I'm sure, like, it would have been different if you had taken the stuff out of the truck, he looked at it, you know, gave it, like, a once-over and be like, you know what, I'm really just not interested in it.
Right.
At least,
yeah.
Even if he never had any intention, yeah. At least yeah. He's
there all day.
Right. And also honoring the fact that, like, you explained to him right. why you were there, you know, yeah. And it's just like, okay. I mean, because I had, when I had my record store in Arizona, people would bring in record, you know, their collection to sell right. to me. And there'd be times where I'd have a bin of, you know, probably 40 records, and I'd get six or seven in, and I'd be like, there's nothing in this collection that I want.
Right.
I would still go through the whole thing because they lugged it in, and, right. you know, yeah. and I would always, from my years of working at Bull Moose, learn, like, the mentality is if someone's bringing it into the store, they've already gotten rid of it in their mind.
Right.
So I would always make them an offer, unless right. it was, like, complete garbage.
Right.
I'd be like, well, not a whole lot that is going to move pretty quickly here. This is what I can give for you. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, people are like, do you know what this stuff is worth? And I'm like, well, worth is a subjective term.
Right.
It's not worth that to me,
right?
Because I got to turn around and sell it, and I know what's going to sell. But at least I gave yeah. them the time to
right.
Okay, you brought it in, I'll check it out yeah. for you. So yeah,
I mean, this guy, like, who? This guy had no idea. Maybe I was just $500 shy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's it. And what I brought him was worth way more than $500.
Sure.
But maybe that's all I needed, and that's right. all I needed to take. And maybe I would have taken it. He has yeah. no idea. He doesn't yeah. know me.
Right.
You know? He didn't even extend, and it's not like it's any work for him to have me bring a 100-pound amplifier inside his shop.
Right.
I'm carrying it.
Right.
I can carry it back out to my car if he doesn't want
yeah,
it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah. So you're the third person I've told this story to today, yeah. and all three people agree that it was kind of a shitty thing. Imagining this.
No, all right. I would say so.
All right. You're not allergic to bees or anything, are you?
No. Okay. I mean, well, we'll find out.
Okay, I'm just making sure.
I can't remember the last time I've been stung by a bee.
They like this Mandevilla plant.
Yeah. I had a friend who, which I found out through Facebook, she tagged me in a post, which I'm not sure exactly why, but I'm not, like, angry about it, because I don't know if I would have seen it, because she doesn't post stuff all that mm-hmm. often, but she was in her backyard with her husband early in the morning, and she had ended up stepping on a nest of yellow jackets that was in the ground.
Yeah, they're mean. They're aggressive.
Well, and she said because it was so cold, they were pretty lethargic, but she was, like, getting, like, stung all over. So it was sort of a humorous story, because she was just like, at 9 a.m, I stripped down butt naked in my backyard and was running around. And she's like, I'm sure it was a funny sight to see, but, yeah, I just thought that was funny. So
it was funny.
No, I can't remember the last time I've been stung by a bee. Probably 20 years. I've been stung by a scorpion more recently than a wow. bee. So, yeah.
That's something that has not happened to me.
It's, I don't recommend it.
I'm sure.
It's not awesome. And it was also, we were, so we moved out to Arizona, me and my girlfriend at the time, and we lived in Tempe, which is a mm-hmm. suburb of Phoenix. Yep. I don't know if you've been out to Arizona or not.
Briefly.
Yeah.
Spent a couple of days there.
Yeah, that's about the amount of time I would recommend someone spend in Arizona.
Yeah, I did 2 days in New Mexico and 2 days in Arizona. That was enough.
Sure. I'm going to all 50 states. I'm psyched to go to New Mexico because my friend's going to take me to George O'Keefe's house.
Right on.
I'm a huge George O'Keefe fan.
I am not.
Yeah.
I am in the other camp altogether.
Why is that?
I just think it's boring.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, I mean, there's some art that's boring that I like, but I don't know. I guess what it is, it's not that it's bad.
Right.
And of course, that's all, you know, and art is one of my favorite subjects to talk about, because
yeah.
I as much as I love art, and I say this respectfully because you are a painter.
Yeah.
But what I've always found fascinating about the art world is there's an enormous amount of bullshit involved.
Oh, for certain.
And I'll tell you a classic story of that. After I give you my Georgia O'Keefe thing.
Yeah.
You know, essentially, I think she's a little bit of a one-trick pony.
Sure. She definitely has, I mean, the two most well-known things, the flowers
yeah.
and the skulls.
Right, right. Yeah. And she's a great artist. I just think that, I guess what it is for me is, it's, I feel about Georgia O'Keefe the way a lot, I guess my feelings about Georgia O'Keeffe are like my feelings about B.B. King.
Okay.
Georgia O'Keeffe is like the B.B. King of the art world.
Sure.
Where she definitely has her place historically.
Yeah.
Just like B.B. King does. But I think there are so many blues guitar players that are way fucking better than B.B. King.
Sure. And it's also, he's kind of the household, for people who don't listen to blues, he is the blues guy to them.
He's not threatening, he's not scary.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, as long, you know, he's basically one toe more into the blues pool than Eric Clapton.
Right,
is. You know what I mean? You're just like, no, I totally get what you're saying. And I mean, and B.B. King himself was a self-admitted terrible guitar player. Right. He was just like, I don't know how to play chords. I just do the... I mean, I love in... Did you ever see U2's Rattle and Hum, that movie?
I have not, no.
Because they did the When Love Comes to Town with him, and they were talking about, right, because they wrote the song and then had B.B. King sing on it, and they show the rehearsal for it, and they're like, well, you can play this, and he's like, no, I can't. He's like, I'm no good at chords. I just kind of do my thing. He's like, that's why I always have at least another guitar player on stage with me. Which I thought was interesting that he was such a big iconic guy, and he's not like he was not an amazing musician. I mean, he had a distinct place, and yeah, he was sort of the like you were saying, the safe entry into the blues.
Yeah,
and I can totally see that. My connection to Georgia O'Keeffe is a weird one because I think if you just look at her stuff, it's particularly the flower stuff. It's the type of art that you could see hanging on, like, motel walls, stuff like that.
Right,
where it's colors and shapes. It's pleasant enough, but it doesn't jump out to you. But, so, growing up religious in the church, when I was an adolescent, when I first started drawing, I was drawing skulls and, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah. And my mom would throw out all the drawings I did of skulls, saying they were demonic and satanic and whatnot.
Yeah, that's a whole another weird
thing. It was, but it was interesting. So when I was a junior, we went to some art museum that had a Georgia O'Keeffe exhibit. And our assignment was you had to pick something that you saw at the museum and do a reproduction of, like do your own version of it.
Right.
And that was like our final project. So at the gift shop, I bought, you know, a little, you know, 9x12 reproduction of this one piece, and because my thought, and it's the deer skull with the blue background, and so I went home and I did it but I was more excited that I was going to get to draw a skull, and my parents couldn't yell at me because it was a school assignment.
Right.
So I did it, and I think I probably got like a B+ or whatever on it. But I hung up, I like every apartment that I ever lived in, I, you know, I put the thumbtack through that particular reproduction, not my own version, but the Georgia O'Keeffe one that I had bought. And it's weird seeing a picture, like a painting that you've seen your entire life, like a reproduction or, you know, online or something, and then getting to see it in person for the first time. Cause, I went down to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts with a friend a couple months ago.
I love that place.
It's amazing. And she has a membership. So every couple of months, she's like, hey, I'm going to go down. You want to come down with me? And I went down, and I didn't know that there was an O'Keeffe exhibit at the time. It's not a permanent part of the collection. And we went in and we saw the banner. And I said, you guys have some O'Keeffes here right now? She said, yeah, it's like on the third floor or whatever. So I was like, okay. And the vinyl banner that I like saw, you know, had that particular piece there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just seeing that, like, it was weird. I mean, even just talking about it now, it's doing, like, all the hair on my arms was standing up. And so we went up, and it's not a big room. It's, I think there's maybe 12 pieces, and it's just a, you know, square room. But we opened the door to it, and that piece is on the far wall staring at you. And so I went around the room looking at it, and... It was big, you know, it was bigger than I had imagined, but it was just, I had never, like, you know, people joke about art museums and people being pretentious in art museums, and I just, standing in front of that thing, I just started just bawling.
Yeah.
It was crazy, the power of that.
I have a similar story, actually.
Yeah.
I went, I was in New York City when I came back from, I was in New York City in 2015, beginning of 2015, I think. I just decided to go there for the weekend, and I went to the Met.
Yeah.
I'd never been to the Met. And I've always had, you know, certainly had an appreciation for art. Goya is one of my favorite artists.
Yeah.
And actually, I think I went to the Met because I had a Goya exhibit there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I do remember going to see a Goya exhibit and being surprised at how incredibly small most of his works were.
Sure.
I was expecting them to be like, you know.
Yeah.
But they're all like tiny. They're like, you know, 3x5s
or
whatever. But anyway, walking through like the, you know, the impressionist wing or whatever, and never really gave much thought to Van Gogh.
Sure.
And then I stood right in front of a Van Gogh painting, like for the first time, like 12 inches away.
Yeah.
And literally was moved to tears by it.
Sure.
It was the most incredible thing I had ever seen. So much so that, you know, the Clark Institute out in Williamstown, Mass.
Yeah.
Had a Van Gogh exhibit the next year, and I went just to see all as many of his paintings as I could. I couldn't believe how much emotion, how much expression was in every single, like, thick giant glob of paint and brush strokes.
His stuff is chunky.
It's like super intense.
Yeah.
Like really, really intense. And I was like, I was amazed by that. It was really profound. Like,
sure.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things where I don't typically get personal on Facebook anymore, but I posted a picture of that painting and I was like, I can't believe what I'm looking at right now. Like, this is amazing. Like, I'm so moved by this.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where I actually felt like I had to share that with people because,
for
like,
sure.
If you haven't seen this, you need to see this.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, yeah, man, it was incredible. But then the flip side of it for me is actually, I'm going to run right inside here real quick, and I'm going to show you something. So, this. So, I made this on my lunch break one day when I was, like, working in a steel shop.
Yeah.
Right? It took me 5 minutes. Now, I go into museums and I see, or galleries, and I, you know, that sell modern art, and I see people that have welded pieces of metal together similar to this, and they're selling them for like $5,000.
Right.
And the difference is theirs is in a gallery and it's called art.
Right.
And mine is not.
Sure.
Like, perfect example. This is my favorite example. I was driving across country once years ago, and I was in Minneapolis. And I went to whatever art museum is in Minneapolis, and they happened to be having a Jeff Koons exhibit.
Okay.
So I went in, and I actually didn't know who Jeff Koons was at the time. So first there are all his like Mylar balloon things, and then there are his basketballs and vacuum cleaners suspended in that Lucite or whatever it is.
Right.
And then there's this whole room of his like Cicciolina works. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not familiar with those.
So Cicciolina was this Italian porn star in the late 80s, early 90s, and then she ran for parliament and all this stuff. But he did this whole photo set of him and her banging.
Okay.
You know, just like pictures of them fucking.
Right.
And, you know, there's a 6 foot long poster of him like blowing a load all over her on a museum wall.
Right.
And you can buy a print of that for like $10,000.
Right.
Or you can go around the corner and buy a Hustler.
Yeah, for $6.
Yeah, for $5.99.
Yeah.
But his is art.
Right.
And that's pornography.
Right.
Why, man?
It's all just about the lighting.
Yeah, right? Or it's what you call it. It's what you label it.
Yeah, it's funny because I've had, you know, I do a lot of animal paintings, but I also I've done a series of watercolors now of, like, nude and semi-nude women.
Yeah.
And it's funny, too, because
which are really lovely, by the way. I like them.
Thank you. It's one of those things that I've gotten different reactions from it. Although I will say that, you know, and just judging by social media, you know, Instagram and Facebook, I have way more women that click on the like or, you know, like, oh, I love this than men, which is interesting. But I also feel
that is interesting.
But I feel like women, particularly in this culture, women, it's far more acceptable for women to be appreciative of the female form than it is for men to be appreciative of the male form.
Certainly.
You know, but be that, you know, as it may, there's been certain people that have been like, oh, so you like painting porn pictures? And I'm just like, well, how, I'm like, first of all, it's not like graphic, like, right. And it's funny because I have gotten commissions for a couple like fairly graphic things, mm-hmm. and you know, within reason, I'm like, sure, I'll give it a shot, but I also don't post those,
right?
You know, because I know right. as much as someone might be like, oh wow, his attention to detail is pretty amazing. It's gonna, you know, for the three people that might do that, there right. there's gonna be 50 people be like, oh god, yeah. I don't want to.
Gross.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, it's very interesting. It's all about you know what you call it, but also what the viewer mm-hmm. brings to it. So yeah, that's interesting about the huge
yeah.
reproductions.
Yeah, and, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I was like, what a hustle, man! What a scam.
Which my guess is there's probably at some point when he was working on it, he's like, watch what I'm gonna get these rich motherfuckers to hang in a museum.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And God bless him for doing that. You know, yeah. if you can manipulate the system like that,
right.
go for it, man. Like, yeah. I don't have a problem. I have no objection to what he did.
Yeah.
Or what was on the walls whatsoever. Good for him, man. Yeah. That's great. If he can make a living like banging hot Italian girls, cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. You know? I don't know if you remember, and I don't remember if it was Serrano or Satori. I don't remember his last name.
Piss Christ?
Yeah
Piss Serrano, Christ. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, if you didn't know the name of the piece and you just saw it, it's a beautiful photograph.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's super cool.
It's gorgeous. It's this yellow to amber yeah. hue, and the way it's lit is gorgeous. But for those not familiar with it, the piece is called Piss Christ, and right. what it is, you know, I mean, it's not even that. The original is not that big. Like, it's yeah. just a plastic Jesus crucifix submerged in a vat of his urine.
Right.
And then, you know, it's there's a lot of effects on it and whatnot.
Right.
And he's also done, like, because he did the, you know, the Metallica album, Load. Mm-hmm. He did the cover for that. Yeah. He didn't do it for them. They took an existing piece of right. his. But what it is because at that point, Lars Ulrich was very into buying art, and he mm-hmm. had seen it, and he approached him about licensing it for it. But all it is blood and semen between right. two pieces of plexiglass.
Yeah.
And when he presented it to James Hetfield, he's like, I want to use this for the cover. He's like, it looks like somebody blew their load on there. And he's like, that's exactly what it is. And hence the title of the album, right. Load. But just as a, the aesthetic of it is, you know, kind of captivating and certainly interesting, but yeah, the intention of offending people there is certainly, you know, or at least right. getting a reaction out yeah, of people is absolutely. Beyond the visual. So yeah, that's always interesting to me too. The piece that you were just talking about, which I think I'm going to take a photo of it, and that'll be the episode.
Cool.
Those are metal shears.
Yeah, there's a pair of tin
snips.
These are tin snips, and then these are like little blacksmith pliers, essentially.
Yeah, but yeah. It's not a tripod. I guess it's a table since it's got four legs.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know what
you call
it.
It's pretty cool though.
Yeah, I have tons of this stuff in a Rubbermaid container. You know, just yeah. like tons of it. You know, and I said to myself one day, you know, maybe someday I'll see if I can throw these in a gallery somewhere and charge sure. ridiculous money for something that took me no time at all.
Yeah.
You know? Another thing that I actually wanted to do is when I was working in Zambia, I spent a lot of time taking portraits of the people that worked for me.
Sure.
I
remember seeing a lot of photos from your yeah. time over there. So.
And I have this whole, I have like hundreds of black and white portraits of, and I, without sounding, trying to sound immodest, I think they're beautiful pictures,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, I should do like a book. And I even had a title like worked out. It was going to be called Work and Worship. Cause
yeah.
the two things that people in Africa do is they go to church and they go to work.
Yeah.
You know?
yeah
it's
yeah.
like, and I had lots of pictures from churches while I was there too. So I was like, Work and Worship, that's going to be the book, you know? And then the whole prospect of like getting that together and trying to get it published was daunting, and I was just
sure.
like, ah, fuck it, I'm not doing it. Maybe I should have, you know? But the whole self-publishing thing, I think, is it's not, I don't know.
It's
hard.
It is a lot of work, and I really feel like there's sort of a stigma's not the right word, but there's a attitude of if you self-publish, well, that's not a real book.
Yeah, because, you know, somebody else didn't foot the bill for it. It's like being in a band and like trying to get a record label to give you a deal.
Right.
I mean, anybody can do like a crowdfunding thing and make a record. If you have enough money, you can release your own material,
right,
which I've done.
Yeah.
But there's something very different about having a record label say, we want to pay to put this out for you because you're that good.
Right.
This book is good enough that we want to foot the bill to put it out there.
Sure.
And by doing that, we're going to take a large percentage of what you make. Cool. But we think it's good enough. And yeah, I think there is that sense that, you know, if you self-publish, it's not a quote-unquote real book.
Right. Which, you know, is absolutely ludicrous. But there is that
true
mentality. And it's funny with albums, too, because, you know, any band who has any, you know, notoriety is not the right word, but any band that is known to the general public, originally, you know, they probably put out some stuff on their own.
Yeah.
Like, you look at anyone's Wikipedia page and the first two things, they're like, well, this is the first album, they were self-released. I'm
right.
Like, no shit, because
yeah,
that's how every band does it. It's just not everyone gets a record deal from that point on.
Right.
And it's, those are looked at as sort of less than.
Right.
And, but then a lot of bands reach the point, you know, bands like Radiohead or Nine Inch Nails, where they're then on their own label again because they've made enough money and they're like, oh, I'm getting screwed by this deal.
Right.
I can make more money on my own. But they had to have a label initially kind of get them out to
right
a larger audience. And also, I mean, the way the music industry has changed so much in the last half decade is crazy. I mean,
oh, for sure.
I mean, I don't know if there's going to be any huge rock and roll bands in the next generation.
Yeah, I tend to doubt it.
Yeah.
Which sucks, because I mean, I'm in a rock and roll band. I love playing rock and roll.
Yeah.
Like, I love it.
Every person that I know who plays rock and roll is, like, our age or, like,
yeah,
5 years younger than us,
yeah,
or 10 to 15 years older than us.
Right, right.
And it's what they do because it's their passion
right
in their downtime, you know.
I mean,
I know one guy who, and it's funny because you and I were talking about that Danzig Corrosion of Conformity show. Steven Brodsky, his band Mutoid Man, opened
and they're
the
awesome
show.
They
Mutoid
are
Man,
awesome. Yeah,
yeah, and
yeah,
they're just like on the up and up. It's funny though because he was in another band who, you know, were on a major label for one album. He was in a band called Cave In, which technically he still is. But the other guys in Cave In all have daytime jobs.
Right.
You know, the bass player's a carpenter in Bow, New Hampshire now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did an episode, it was like 23, I think, with Adam McGrath, who's the guitar player for that, and he's an administrator at Northeastern University now. You know, they're all doing
right
stuff like that. Like, Steve Brodsky's the only one who's like really doing
yeah
music as his full time thing, but he's also like the only one who's not like married or with kids
right
or whatnot. So
right,
you know, I mean, and that's going back to my whole going on this trip thing. I don't have
right
any attachments right now, so I'm like, this is the time for me to do this.
For sure.
I've been thinking about this trip for a long time, and it's time to put it into practice.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see. Speaking of that, yeah, I mean, the band you play in, it's Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Are you guys play out fairly regularly?
We try to, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're trying to get some more gigs in the Boston area. There's actually a really good like rock and roll scene in Boston right now.
Yeah.
A lot of good bands. Worshipper, Jesus, Cortez, Gozu, Summoner, like tons of good bands.
I think I've seen you guys play with Gozu a couple times.
Yeah, we've played with Gozu several times actually. They're an awesome band. Really, really talented guys. We're playing the Portsmouth Halloween Parade fundraiser thing
yep
on the 5th of October. That's the next gig. We were in the studio, Wild Arctic,
where's
in Portsmouth.
That?
Dean Baliotonis owns it. It's over by the Portsmouth Library, actually.
Okay.
We recorded five or six songs with him, and that stuff's going out to get mastered next week. So, again, hoping to find a small indie label. There are a lot of stoner band labels out there right now.
Sure.
There's like STB Records, there's Twin Earth, there's Ripple Music. Trying to find somebody that will maybe do like a cool like splattered vinyl 10-inch.
Sure.
Three songs per
sure
side.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah.
So we're trying to get some merch together and all that stuff. But yeah, man, I mean, and I'm blessed to have two really rock solid musicians
yep
in the band. I mean, Jeff is just a superb bass player.
Yeah, bringing it back to what we were talking about earlier, I actually married Jeff and his wife.
I know. I know. He actually told me, I told him I was hanging out with you today. He said to say hi, and he said he'd see you next week.
Yeah, sweet. Yeah, I think he said something about coming to the yard sale.
He's an amazing bass player and a rock solid human being.
Yeah.
And Sean is a phenomenal drummer as well. We all gel really, really well. Practice is something that we all look forward to, and we're writing some new stuff right now. And we all have, like, you know, Jeff and I have both, I think, found, and this is something that matters a lot more to me now than it used to. You know, I think Jeff and I have both, like, found our gear set up.
Sure.
And everything's dialed in. Like I've got the right head, the right speaker cab, the right guitar. You know, he's definitely got the right bass and the right cab and the right head as well. And it's just our two instruments, our two setups sound really good together. Like, it's crazy. And
yeah,
we played at the Brick House a couple of weeks ago, and somebody actually came up to me and said, "Hey, I've seen you guys play several times, but you guys got your tone like dialed in."
That's like, awesome.
Yeah. And it's really satisfying. And like, you know, we had practice on Wednesday, and you know, I came home and I was like, "Man, practice was awesome. Like, it was fucking awesome. We sounded so good. Like, everything just sounds like huge and crisp." And yeah, it's cool. It's a lot of fun. And you know, even if we ever get rich and famous, you know, it's a blast to do. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, anybody that plays in a band that says that they don't care about, like, they don't care about, like, getting rich and famous, I think is not entirely truthful.
Sure.
Because, I mean, we all do it. Well, most of us do it because we love it. But because we love it, we all want to do it full time.
Sure.
You know, I mean, if I could quit running a tractor trailer repair shop, which is what I do right now, and play guitar instead, and have that be my paycheck every week, I mean, I wouldn't think twice about it.
Sure.
It's a no-brainer.
Sure.
You know? And I think, you know, 98% of musicians out there would say the same thing.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. There's a buddy of mine who is doing music now as his full-time gig, who I'm sitting down with next week, that I'm interested to hear his take on it, if it's, you know, because that was the dream for so long and he slugged it out for years, and now he's finally playing with a band that, you know, tours constantly and he makes his living. And I'm sort of curious if it's like, okay, well, is it what you were hoping for? You know, so it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that conversation goes.
Right on.
Too. He's got a sliver of time. He lives in New Hampshire, but he's, you know, they're about to go to South America for like a month and a half.
So. Pop rock band?
Ish.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about it after we record. I'm sure you know who I'm talking about, or it might have a good idea.
Yeah, I have a pretty good idea. I'm pretty sure I know which band you're talking about.
Yeah.
There are very few New Hampshire guys that are doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm happy for those guys.
And that's the thing too. I'm not saying it like trying to shit on
them. Yeah, no, I'm super happy for them.
But yeah.
I would do it.
Yeah, for sure. And that goes back to what you were saying about, if you ask most people who are musicians, hey, here's this opportunity, do you want to do it? I think like 99 out of 100 would be like, absolutely. Right. Even if it's not necessarily 100% what, you know,
right.
I mean, because going back to before we started recording, when we were talking about Danzig, and, you know, a lot of people that we know in common have said it wasn't a very good show. And I was talking about how there were, you know, it's a lot of hired musicians playing with Danzig now. But for some weird, you know, circumstances, if someone came to you and be like, "Hey, Todd, do you want to play guitar with Danzig for the next 4 months?" I'm sure you'd at least consider it.
Of course I would.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I knew a guy that jumped on tour with Social Distortion.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody said, "Hey, Johnny," somebody called me and said, "Johnny Two Bags can't do this tour."
Right.
I'd be like, "Oh, hell yeah."
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. it sort of brings it back. So you played with the Bruisers back in the day.
Way back, yeah.
How long ago was that? That was before Al was in the Dropkick Murphys.
Yeah. I played with them the first, I kind of played with them twice around, really. The first time around, I played bass, and that was in like 1990, 91. Then I moved to the West Coast to go to college, and I filled in as a touring guitar player.
Okay.
When Jeff couldn't do the tours, because, you know, Jeff was, you know, he had one of those situations where he had a an important job, and he had a wife and he had kids.
Yeah.
And so he really just couldn't afford to do the tour stuff. So he did the records and he did a lot of the writing. He did most of the musical writing, and you know, and Al wrote a lot of the lyrics. And you know, I think the lyrics, if I remember correctly, a lot of them were collaborative between him and Jeff and Dan or whatever. But Jeff did most of the music, as far as I remember.
Yeah.
But he couldn't do a lot of the touring stuff. So I would like the Bruises' first European tour. I guess you could say I wasn't technically really a full-time band member, but I came home from Oregon to do the European tour, yeah. and play that tour, which was one of the greatest experiences of my life.
Yeah.
I mean, just, we toured with Madball,
yeah.
and we did like seven countries or whatever, and we did it, you know, over the course of 4 or 5 weeks or something. And it was just a blast. And to be like...
And you were on guitar.
Yeah, and I was on guitar, which is what I wanted to do, you know, which is what, I mean, I can play bass, but guitar is what I love to do,
sure.
you know? And so it was great to like be, you know, be playing in front of 1,500 people playing guitar solos and, you know,
right.
and people are, you know, singing the words to your songs and pumping their fists. And it was like, this is the greatest, yeah. man. Like, this is the greatest. And, you know, meeting so many great people, and I have so many great stories and photo albums full of pictures of us. I mean, I was 20.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And then I did another European tour with them in 97. I was on when the Bruises kind of did their first reunion in like 1990 or whatever. They did the American Night single. So I played bass on that. And yeah. then we did an EP called Still Standing Up in probably, I don't know, 95, 96.
Yeah.
And I was on that. I played lead guitar on that. And then after that came out, we did another European tour with the Vanilla Muffins, which was actually even more fun than the first tour. That was a blast.
Who was playing bass at that point? Was Johnny?
Johnny Rio, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I went to high school with Johnny.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so Johnny played bass on that tour. Richie played bass on the first tour.
Yeah.
It was a blast, man. It was, like, super, super, super fun. Yeah, I wouldn't trade those two tours for anything, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I consider myself to be very fortunate to have had those two opportunities.
Nice.
For sure. Great memories, you know?
Yeah.
Definitely.
And you're playing, you have a solo show next week.
Thursday, yeah, at Thursday, what, the 14th, at Woodland Farms Brewery,
yeah,
in Kittery, right across from the Trading Post. Yeah, I'm excited about that. It's a nice brewery. You know, my friend Junior is one of the owners. He plays in Kraken's Beard and in
Patrick
Prendergast.
Prendergast, yeah. for those who don't know, yeah.
yeah, yeah, he plays in the Bog Standard and in Kraken's Beard, both of which are great bands, totally different things. Bog Standard does like sea shanties and pirate type music.
Oh, okay.
And Kraken's Beard is like a kind of a stoner metal type thing.
Yeah, it's definitely got like a Clutch kind of vibe
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, they're really good, actually. Yeah. And I keep trying to get them to play shows with us, but they...
Haven't you played with them before?
Nope, never. And I've always wanted to, but they...
It must have been...
Scheduling issues.
Because I know I saw you guys with Scissor Fight, and I'm pretty sure I've seen them with Scissor Fight.
Yep.
But, I mean, I've seen Scissor Fight like 5 times in the last year and a half,
yeah.
so...
Yeah, yeah. They played with Scissor Fight once, and we did too. But yeah, we have not, unfortunately, we have not shared a stage. We have shared a stage with Sam Hill,
yeah.
a couple times, which is great. We played at your party yep. together.
Yep.
Well, I played with them at your party, but then Bigfoot played with them at the Brick House and at the Thirsty Turtle in Nashua, and another killer band with three really rock solid human beings in it.
Four now.
Four?
Yeah, Russ Graham's playing guitar with them now.
No
too.
Kidding, really?
Yeah, yeah, it was. It's funny. So I did. I did an episode with Cam a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, that was one of the ones I checked out.
And he couldn't be at the Congress of Sound, so Russ played bass on that. But they had been wanting to add another guitar player for a while, and he showed up to rehearsal, I guess, with knowing all the songs, and you know, and then hearing them, they're like, "You want to play guitar for us after this?" So he filled in, and it's funny because I recorded a podcast at the Congress of Sound with Eric Claxton from the Soggy Paw Boys,
mm-hmm.
but it was with Sam Hill playing in the background.
Oh,
so,
nice.
So the soundtrack of that
nice.
Podcast. So yeah, Sam, and I got to sit down with Nate at some point and talk, but I know it's not going to happen before I head out
yeah.
on the road. But I mean, that's the great thing about doing this for me was there's a lot of people, I mean, this area's got so many amazing musicians, writers, and artists.
It's rich in artistic talent for sure.
Yeah, and it's you know, when I first started doing this, I was like, I'm going to make a list of people I know who I'd like to sit down and have yeah. a conversation with. And I was like, I'll probably get like 30 or 40 names. And the initial list I wrote, I got 176 names.
Wow.
And I'm like, like, fuck, if I put one of these up a week, that's 3 years plus right there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy because, you know, I've been doing it a little over 4 months and I've already got 30 episodes up. And then in 2 months, I'm going to have 50 more. So it's great.
That's awesome. And you know what is cool about this area, too, kind of artistically, is it's not particularly catty either.
Yeah, you know I would agree.
People are pretty cool with each other, you know. Yep. There's not, you know, we're not surrounded by a bunch of divas, you know, and, you know, everybody's willing to, you know, shake hands and be polite with each other and welcoming. And there's a lot of, it's nice when you see, you know, other people from other bands come to see your band play, you know,
for sure.
They take the time to come out, you know, like, you know, Jarvis and Doug from Scissor Fight have come to a couple of Bigfoot shows.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. It's always good to see them, you know. And I was in a band with Jarvis and Jay for a little while, for like a...
Oh, really? What band was that?
Diesel Wolf. It was okay. Kind of... It was before Scissor Fight got back together. We tried the side project thing. I think Jay and Jarvis were really kind of... In the back of their minds, always were really kind of set on getting Scissor Fight back together.
Doing Scissor Fight again.
Yeah. So, yeah, they had the Super Machine thing. That kind of went south, and then... I played rhythm guitar and sang for, you know, we started to sing. We played like two shows.
Yeah.
And then they just said, it's not really what I want to do. And then, so that's when I kind of approached Jeff, you know, and said, hey, man, I hear you're a hell of a bass player. I've never heard you play.
Yeah.
And I was, nothing but impressed with that kid, man.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a cool scene. It's definitely, I think it's a better scene than it was 20 years ago.
Sure.
In terms of how people are personality wise.
Sure.
Certainly the area is rich in talent.
It's one of those things that I've certainly been like in the last 2 years, whenever I go and see a band locally, I'm like, man, wish I was in a band now. Cause you know, I did a band in the early to mid 90s and it's one of those things I know I could if I decided to put my mind to it, but like there's only so much gas in the tank.
Yeah,
and
I know.
I'm trying to do the art as much as possible right now. So yeah. I'm like, who knows, maybe 2-3 years down the road. I mean, Cam and I have talked about doing some stuff at different points and, you know, had different ideas for different guitar players and stuff like that, but who knows?
Right.
We'll see. You know.
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely a pretty not only not catty, but I feel like in general a really supportive
absolutely
community.
And you know what community I think is actually even more supportive is the Manchester community.
Really?
Manchester scene, yeah. It's a really, really it's a really tight scene.
Yeah.
Everybody comes out to everybody else's shows all the time.
And there's also more places for people to play.
True.
There.
True, yeah. Absolutely. You know, for a while I played lead guitar in a Manchester band called To the Gallows when I first came back too, and I was doing Bigfoot and To the Gallows, and I loved it, man. I had no problem being in multiple bands. You know, we each practiced one night a week. It wasn't a ton of time, if Lucero was more punk rock.
Okay,
that's
less
kinda,
country, more punk rock.
Yeah, that's kind of what we were. And Josh Lessard, the singer and other guitar player, is actually a hell of a writer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's not particularly old. Like, yeah, he's got a lot of wisdom in him for being a young man.
Nice.
Yeah, and he's a good front man. And he actually, similar to you, he had a good job that he hated.
Yeah.
You know, so and similar to me as well. And he said, I'm young. I'm going to cash in my savings and I'm just going to Europe.
Yeah.
With no ETA.
That's awesome.
And just so you know, we called the band called the quits and he got on a plane and just he was not gone nearly as long as I thought he would be.
Yeah.
But he had a hell of a time and he came back and now he's kind of pursuing the kind of solo thing.
Yeah.
But he's a great young man and it was a pleasure to play in that band. And Lee and Adam, the drummer and bass player, also rock solid guys, and Lee is an amazing drummer.
Yeah.
And he's doing this pop punk band now with Tristan Omond.
Okay.
Called Donaher, and apparently they're on the map. Apparently they're getting played on 92.5 a little bit here and there.
Wow.
Which is really good. I mean, I'm really happy for those guys. And then Lee's he's a hilarious guy and a great drummer. So I've been fortunate since I've been back to have been able to hook up with some really talented individuals, which is good. Like, you know, playing with Jeff and Sean forces me to bring my A game.
Sure.
You know, it's, and for me, it's actually really, really good to not feel like I'm the strongest link in the chain.
Sure.
It's humbling, and it forces me to get better.
Sure.
Like when you're in a band with people where, and maybe it's just in your head, but when you're in a band with people and you feel like, you know, you are like a step above the rest of the people in your band, sometimes you get complacent or you get, you know, bored or whatever. But yeah, like working with Jeff and Sean, like we all kind of, I think, bring the best out in each other.
Yeah.
And I'm really thankful for that. And it makes me a better guitar player. Like, every time, you know, we play a show, you know, I just think that I'm better than I was the show before.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah. It also helps that I don't drink before I play anymore.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
I'll have one or two, but that's it. You know,
yeah.
You know, I used to drink a lot all night, gig nights. And with my solo stuff, it was kind of like part of the show was like, you know, they're like, I think I have this great picture that somebody took the foot of the stage, and I'm, you know, I'm wearing these black and white, like old wingtips, and there's like six shots of bourbon laid out in front of my feet and like two empty ones. And I was like, yeah, that was my thing, man.
Yeah.
But, you know, I realized I'm just a much better performer.
Sure.
When I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe some people won't find it as entertaining, but, you know, people that appreciate what I do appreciate it more.
Sure, for sure.
And I like to be able to look back and go, yeah, man, that was rock solid. You know,
yeah.
that was a good show.
Yeah.
But the other thing is when you play sober, you also become far more aware of your own shortcomings and mistakes.
Sure.
When you play too. But you learn from those,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
You're like, oh yeah, I fucked that up.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas it's like, oh, I don't remember. Did I fuck that up? But whatever.
Right. You know? Yeah. Instead of yeah, fuck it. It was a show.
Right.
It's okay. Cool. Next
right.
time, I'm gonna
right.
work on this harder and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Sure. Awesome.
And sometimes I certainly don't think lately I've been spending enough time playing at home and writing. I started writing again recently, but yeah, I need to get back on that. I need to put out some new stuff.
Yeah.
Both individually and with the band. But the band is doing okay with writing. We got a lot of new music. We're just lyrics are much harder for me than music, as they are for a lot of people.
But, yeah.
It's all good.
Cool.
We'll get there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for taking the time to
sure.
chat.
Sure. No, thank you. And it's great to see you.
It's you too.
Great to have the chat.
Cool.
For sure.